Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Brandon Hiller, 30 years of combination experience, a battalion chief in the 1st Battalion for Anne Arundel County Fire on B Shift. Brandon was attending college for an engineering degree when his living situation on campus wasn't desirable. He turned to the local county fire department live-in program, which allowed him to attend classes, but also ended up being the best decision he made for his career. It was nothing for him and other individuals to run over 2,000 incidents a year, which most certainly has its positives when it comes to gaining experience. Soon after, Brandon knew he wanted to go career and got hired on Anne Arundel. Climbing through the ranks now as a battalion chief, one of the best statements I've heard was Brandon's state. As a leader, he wants to be tactically proficient enough where his decision-making would be trusted. With that, I present Brandon Hiller.
Hey, Danny, thanks for having me on. My name is Brandon Hiller. I'm a battalion chief with Anne Arundel County, Maryland. Got started in June of 95, actually, as a 14-year-old volunteer in a small rural department. Moved up to Prince George's County to pursue some higher education and ended up as a live-in in a firehouse there, and then was fortunate to get hired 23 years ago in Anne Arundel, and have been just working my way through that process ever since, trying to be the best employee I could be.
Okay. Any other family member in the fire service, or are you the first one?
So I am, you could call it second generation. I actually grew up the son of an auto mechanic and a school teacher. And my dad, as an auto mechanic, owned a shop, had a tow truck, spent a lot of time on like rescue and recovery on scenes, figured he was going to be on those scenes anyway. And kind of got into the first aid and emergency response side of it. And then in the small town where we grew up, the only real kind of social thing to do was the firehouse. So my brother was a member of that volunteer company. And then all of my friends, their older brothers, were all members of that volunteer company. So that's how we all kind of got into that in our high school years. And that was kind of the social place to be and the place where, you know, those friendships kind of sprouted. So kind of real, we're first generation career, but you know, my dad had a small role in emergency services.
Okay. And, have you always lived in Maryland, or is that just life just kind of gravitated you towards that area?
No, life moved me to Maryland in pursuit of an engineering degree. I grew up, like I said, rural Pennsylvania. I live in Pennsylvania now, back in Pennsylvania, just over the border north of Maryland. But school took me to the University of Maryland, and then the prevalence of career opportunities in the DC Baltimore metro region kept me there for employment.
Okay. And so if you're comfortable stating, what was the first department, or, you know, the first volunteer department that you joined when you're in Maryland?
The department I joined in Maryland was the Chilliwack Delphi, which is Company 34 in Prince George's County. I survived about 24 hours in the dorm room in the University of Maryland with some different roommate situations. And the live-in opportunity was there in that firehouse. I had intended to volunteer while in college anyway. So when the live-in opportunity popped up pretty early in my college career, I moved into that firehouse within a few days to a week of being at the University of Maryland, and then stayed there through 2002 when I got hired. So 99 to 02, I got hired, and then moved to a house with some other firefighters from, you know, Prince George's in DC for a little bit.
Okay.
And FDNY, actually, as we all prepared for jobs, you know.
Okay. Would you say that the living experience that you had totally adapted your mindset to how you view the fire service now? Because, like, we can see that living programs have benefits, but I just want listeners, because, you know, there's a lot of listeners out there who, with social media today, they see that attraction. Because I know, especially in the DMV area,
They sh you know they will advertise your own room, college is not too far away, things of that nature. So how vital was that for you to get into a program like that?
Yeah, the live-in experience there, I know Prince George's still has some live-in opportunities. I know Montgomery County has some live-in opportunities. I know kind of up where I am now, like the Harrisburg region, they have live-in opportunities as well. I can honestly say those years when I was there as a live-in, we weren't necessarily riding fat. We were relatively slim as far as how many people were there at the time. So there were two career people around the clock, excuse me, and a day work officer and a day work driver. And those two career people, absolutely, between the call volume in that location and the kind of mentorship and guidance from some of those career people, those things were absolutely impactful on the rest of my career. There were times when there were maybe only three or four of us occupying a bunk room at that time, with the exception of the career people. So there were years where, personally, we had guys and girls running 2,000 calls a year as individuals. So when you think about you're in that firehouse every day, with the exception of, a family break or a spring break or whatever, or an opportunity to get away, you're in that firehouse day and night. Those are, almost compounding years of experience, you know what I mean? If versus if I go to shift work every fourth day, and that's however many work days a year, 96 work days a year, versus you're in that firehouse every day and responsible for emergency services, those things, that exposure is absolutely irreplaceable as far as knowledge, skills, experience, abilities, all those things, And then there are men and women that were there as career people that have been lifelong mentors, and continued to be a positive influence. There are a lot of things that, as a newly hired career firefighter, I had taken away from, the key players that were assigned to that station as huge influences as far as operational readiness and, technical preparation and apparatus care and pride and ownership and love for the job and all those things, came from the examples that had been set for me by some of those people. So you came into the job, maybe as a rookie, but in a really good place. There's an advantage to coming into the job absolutely green, with no, with no bad habits to have to break. I love when we get a rookie that's brand new with absolutely no experience and no, scars. But there's also room for people that come in with some time and experience as well, that that can positively influence an organization and be a top performer.
Definitely. Okay. Now, would you say having that experience under your belt when the time came for you to go career, which is that something you always knew you wanted to go career or?
Oh, absolutely not. No, I thought, I was a volunteer from a kid. I was a volunteer in college. I obviously went to college to pursue that engineering degree. I got into, say, a disagreement with some of the mindset inside the engineering program. The engineering program in Maryland is obviously a fantastic program, has put out, the people that are leading fire service research in the country, at UL and FSRI and all that. When I was in that program and we were having conversations about the fact that we could get to a point where we were like fireproofing America, and my real argument was that you could never remove the human element. No matter what we do, there's going to be a human element that's going to not be able to be completely eliminated, that we can't control. It's a variable that can't be controlled. And I really found passion in being in that firehouse every day. And then, I think I was, like I said, I was 3 years into a degree when I got hired, and I've since completed a degree, not in engineering, not in fire protection engineering, but I've since completed a degree. But It just kind of it steered me into the career path to take a test, or take several tests in the region and then end up in the fire service. And I mean, for anybody, I mean, obviously your listeners are kind of a captive audience or people that are most likely already in the fire service somehow or are
Right.
really interested in the fire service. But it's been an irreplaceable career. You can't believe that, 23 years has gone by as fast as it has. I can't believe what the job has provided as far as success and the capability to provide for a family and the ability to, I mean, we miss, we might miss a holiday, we might miss a birthday because of shift work or whatever, but the ability to be there for a lot of life's biggest moments if you're on a good shift schedule, or I mean, even the guys and girls that work, 10s and 14s, they like that schedule because they go home every day. They see their family every single day where, I might not see mine for 24 or 48, depending on overtime or whatever. But it's allowed me, vacations and breaks when the kids are off in the summer and all those things. It's, so I just kind of I got steered into that career and it stuck,
So, upon getting, was Anne Arundel the first choice, or was it always the destination?
No, my brother had worked in Anne Arundel. He got hired in 98. I got hired in 2002. He's since retired. But he was there, obviously that was one of the first tests that popped up. I had this inkling that I was going to stay a Prince George's County volunteer after I was employed. So I wasn't really interested in testing there. Which was probably, that's falsehood. I've moved on since then and relocated geographically and all those things. So Anne Arundel was the first place that hired, got on that list, got hired at the right time. And then I had taken DC's and I was in the final steps for DC around 2006, 2007, but at that I had already promoted. I was driving. I had a good assignment. I didn't want to leave and start again and lose tenure. So I ended up sticking there, the walking away. I mean, I know in the corporate world, people flip jobs, and pursue better wages and all those things and chase, rolling over 401ks or whatever. And I felt that the time and tenure to just stay where I was, we're a great department. We have good pay. We have, great benefits for the region. Yeah, it was a fine place to stay. So, and now it's a great place to be. So,
And for those that don't know, including myself, can you tell us a little bit about Anne Arundel? How many stations, engines, ladders? It doesn't have to be exact, but just,
now,
approximate.
so we run four battalions. We are just south of Baltimore City. We border Baltimore City to the north, Baltimore County to the north, Howard, Prince George's, and Calvert to the west and south. So we're and then the Chesapeake Bay to the east. We are right between 1,000 and 1,100 career at this point. So it's going to be a pretty decent sized department. We have 31 houses with engines. We have right around 10 trucks, depending on we kind of as things break or reserves go into service, like some of the squad houses end up in a truck here and there. So our truck number kind of fluctuates. We have right around seven squads. And it's we run about we're just under 100,000 calls a year for the department, combined EMS and fire. All those companies, we don't have too many independently staffed companies. Our Brooklyn, which is right at the Baltimore City line, 26 South Glen Burnie has two companies, and which is the busiest suppression companies, and then West Annapolis has two companies just outside Annapolis City. So everyone else swings between typically an engine and special service. We've just completed data study as far as unit utilization that may deploy some more staff special services depending on how, how government systems work and financing and all those things, funding. We'll see what can happen in the coming budget years to try to fulfill some of those needs, but that's where we're at. So 31 houses, 31 engines, and then a mix of special service, and then obviously ALS transport units in all those places as well. And about 100,000 calls a year.
Okay. So you guys do your own transport.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So you're ALS and BLS?
Yep. So primarily, with the exception of there's a few BLS units, and then we're also still a combination department. So we have volunteer companies as well. We have personnel in almost all the houses except for one. That one's not staffed. The rest are a combination of career and volunteer. Well, not the rest, but there are a majority are career, and then some volunteer companies still exist, and they tend to provide BLS service. So there are some BLS units that float that are volunteer companies, and then all the rest of our transport units are one ALS, one BLS provider. So, the tech is determined by the call volume, the call nature, more than anything.
Okay. And your minimum staffing across your apparatuses.
So we run three as a minimum now. The union has got to three. We're pushing towards four. The special service companies, a lot of the squads are running with four because we utilize the squads in non-hydrant boxes as rapid intervention, and we utilize the squads typically as primary search. So we tend to run them with four, and some of the special service companies, the trucks and towers, with four as well. But our true minimum on the engines is three.
Okay. And on a first due within Anne Arundel County structural box, what's your first alarm assignment consist of?
So a hydrant box is five engines, two trucks, a squad, paramedic unit, battalion, two battalion chiefs, EMS officer, safety officer.
Okay. Okay. All right. So I always like to ask questions, let the listeners hear how different departments operate, but all right. So with that being said, I'm going to ask you, so upon getting the call or the letter from Anne Arundel saying, "Hey, we'd love to have you on," what was your first assignment and what was that like?
So, obviously you're barring the fire academy, right? So
Yes.
we
Yes.
run a 24-week fire academy. And then my first assignment was to one of our county is kind of split north and south by Route 50, which runs from Annapolis to DC. And our southern battalion, it's really a great place to work countywide because we have everything from high rises and commercial and industrial and all those special hazards to a heavy amount of highway, right? So we have a fair amount of extrication work as well, to single families, a lot of shotgun houses that popped up post World War II in around DC, Fort Meade, Naval Academy, all those things. And then, older row houses that come, south side of Baltimore City. All those things. And then our southern battalions are truly still, we're starting to see a whole lot more development, but they are still really rural. There's still a lot of farmland, a lot of agriculture down there. So my first assignment, I went from a volunteer station that was all garden style apartments and a heavy immigrant population with all of the nuances that that brings as far as demographic, to a very southern, south side of the county. I went to Deal, which is one of our slower companies. Did have an engine and a truck that we swung, but it was a slower place. And that assignment was, I mean, we're talking at that time probably 700 calls a year, maybe suppression. But I had a fantastic crew. Right. So it was not a great assignment, but I had a really great crew. The lieutenant that I had as my field training officer. So when our recruits come out of the academy, they have a rookie book and they get assigned an FTO, and then the FTO gets them through their 6 months or so of probation. My My first officer was Joe Clausen, who had actually been a long time officer and firefighter at 26, where I ended up being the captain, which was our busiest company at the time, all career house, dual house, all those things. So he was 20 plus years into his career and kind of taking a break. So had moved down to Deal, and I got lucky enough that Joe was my FTO. So like we still got together well. You know what I
Right,
mean?
right.
I had a great partner. I had great chauffeurs. You know, it was not a busy place, but the crew made it what it needed to be somewhere that you could, I don't want to say survive, but
Right.
somewhere that was that it was okay to be slow with good people. You know what I mean? A bad assignment with good people is just sometimes just as good as being in a great house with people that are terrible, you
Right.
know? So that was my first assignment on it probably made me promote a little quicker as an avenue to get out, you know, to drive. I became a an engineman at 3 years. We call, you know, engineman was the old title in the county. We call them chauffeurs. Well, chauffeurs were first, but now we're the actual title is Firefighter 3 was engineman, was the old one. So but it was a slower assignment. It was some operational cultural change from what I was used to. But it was okay, you know. Caught work, but it was you get in the rig and you ride
Right.
20 minutes, you know, in the middle of the night to go to a fire in say Calvert County or another first due that's bordering but still far away. But we caught some work there. You know, had good times. It was fine.
Okay. And how important is it to find, even if it's not presented in front of you? Let's just say, and this is hypothetically speaking, you got out at that station, and it wasn't the greatest crew, but seeking those mentors, even though they might not know that they're mentors to you, how important is that for others to do?
I mean that crew was great, right? So I think you said got to that station. It wasn't great. That station was great. That mentor was great. Joe Clausen was great. Had some good battalion chiefs that were kind of in the tail end of their career. Finding mentors is absolutely irreplaceable. You know, I talked about some of the guys and girls at 34 at Chelm Adelphi, mentors in my own department now, and then. You know, even finding mentors outside of your department, whether it be through training or conferences or mutual friends or whatever. When I moved up to where I live now, I got connected with a retired chief out of Baltimore City who had just left there, who was the, you know, the guy's the same age as my dad, so he's 40 years older than me. But we became kind of fast friends and he was every time that I wanted to like pump the brakes on my career or I wanted to be idle or not necessarily idle, but like every time I got comfortable, right, he would challenge me to be uncomfortable and to push into something different or, you know, encourage me to take another step or try something else or attend something else or any of those things. And then we lost him in, we lost him actually the day I got promoted and left my company as a captain. When I became a chief, my last shift in my company as a captain, we lost him. And like that mentorship void is huge. You know what I mean? 'Cause you're so that when you can see the impact that a really special mentor had in your life, in all things and even on the job, off the job, prioritization of, you know, he would always push, you know, family first and then the job. And at that point, I was really heavily involved in the volunteer service here where I live now, like up through the chief ranks. And he would always push, like, remember, your family is first, then worry about the job because it provides for your family, then focus on this volunteer life. You know what I mean? So, mentorship across an entire career and at all ranks is pretty amazing. And then to see now, Kids, I say kids, we're all in our 40s. Kids that I was in fire school with, and were still burning with our academy classes, and were, getting these newly assigned recruits as FTOs and as new kids in the battalion or whatever, and you're pushing these lessons down from the people that came before you, and you all of a sudden slip up and you realize that you're old, and the opportunity is there to mentor, another generation. And now we're, you're hitting the age where the generation that you initially mentored are becoming officers
Right.
and are getting their own rookies.
Right.
It's crazy.
Well, this next question, if you feel comfortable, and I try not to ask any questions that make guests uncomfortable, but why did you decide to promote to the rank of company officer?
So kind of two reasons. And one goes back to that conversation with that mentor. And did I lose you? Nope.
Nope.
Okay. One, I liked going to fires, and I liked going inside fires.
Okay.
So I love wheeling. I was happy to be a chauffeur. I love being a truck operator. I loved all those things. I was in a great assignment as a driver. I had ended up in, like I said, we're a combination department. I had ended up in a house that was predominantly volunteer, had one driver assigned to it, and then two day workers that staffed suppression and rode the ambulance at that time. So like you were it. You were fulfilling the company role, company officer role, for the most part. You were supervised by an officer at another station. But all of the daily responsibilities of making sure all the admin and logistical needs and all those things were satisfied was kind of already on your shoulders as a driver. And I wanted to get back kind of on the line. You know what I mean? So, and that was also at a point that was, 2008, 2009, like financial crisis time in America. We had kind of had a freeze on, like merits and steps and wages and all those things. So when you're looking at the career as a, I don't want to say a game, but when you're looking at the career strategically as I want to be able to leave this place, right, healthy and financially stable and all those things, right, and you still have to advance your wages. So I wanted to get back on the line. We weren't getting any raises. Promotion seemed like an answer to that. Took that step, and that was really kind of the motivation. I loved driving. It's one of my favorite things. When I get the opportunity, whether it be for a recruit school or anything like that, I still love to run the pump panel and wheel down into the yard a little quick and all that. But to get back on the line and get back inside was kind of the next natural progression.
And now with your role as a battalion chief, that's totally different than a company officer, because unless you have an aide, you're by yourself in the buggy. So I'm sure that new role has its challenges of its own, because you're technically one of the guys, but to some, you're not one of the guys anymore.
You're not, right? So, the way our system works, we don't have aides right now. Our staffing, like I said, our minimum is three. I think our rank, the aides would absolutely be valuable to increase safety and increase operational safety for us and responding and all those things and reduce task saturation. But the guys and girls in the seats on the rigs is also really, really important, so where can we have the most impact? So the career progression from company officer to battalion chief, I got really fortunate. When I got promoted, I went to the training academy as a company officer. I was, like I told you, I was in a great spot as a driver. You know, I got fortunate enough that somebody came down and kind of gave me a heads up and said, "Hey, I think if you take this promotion, you're going to go to the academy." And I think my initial response was, "I don't really think I need to take the promotion." Right. But it gave me enough time to let that sting kind of settle and wear off and realize what could come out of that. So the departmental admin officer part of it was great, 'cause you had impact department wide, ran like special programs, ran our annual training refreshers, ran evaluation of tools and equipment, did introduction to new stuff, you know, deployed rip packs, did a lot of things that we didn't have. And you had a whole lot of influence, again, to be uncomfortable and take a job that didn't seem great. And then went to one of the double houses. So I had a big house, right, with eight people on the floor, and then promoted to captain and went to a double house. So a big house with eight people on the floor. So those houses culturally are fun to be at, right? Because you can't be mad with seven other people around. You know what I mean? Like, if you're having a bad day, then that's fine. But the other seven people are either not going to let you have a bad day or going to bust you so bad until you crack and your day gets better. So it's easy to be upset with two people or three people in a firehouse. It's hard to be upset when you got an army around you that's looking to have a good day. You know what I mean? So then to go to the car is a completely different progression. I felt, and just like all those things of discomfort, I felt I was in the best place I could be as a captain, like the absolute best house. I had nowhere else I wanted to be as a captain. The progression to battalion chief, I felt we had done some really good work in the company I was in, as far as the reputation of the company, the performance of the company, the culture in the company, the expectations of the company, the level of support that the company provided to each other, the way that we were perceived kind of departmentally across all four shifts was really good. And the move to battalion chief gave me the opportunity to try to do that across six companies. You know what I mean? While it's only a shift of the four, and it's only one of our four battalions, so I'm talking about a 16th of the fire department, to try to make a positive impact across more people than the 44 that were assigned to the last company. You know what I mean? So yeah, you know, it's a little bit different, to be alone, to be in the car by yourself. I'm really, really fortunate. The house that we're in, is, you know, 2.3 miles up the road from the house where I was a captain, and we're in 33 at Central and A at in Glen Burnie, and I have a great shift on the floor on my shift. So it really, like, that's, we're not them, but that still feels like our company, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? Like, I have a company officer there, I have a lieutenant there, I have four on the engine of the squad, and then two medic units. So there's four people there, you know, in transport roles, and there's volunteers there, and we have a great relationship with them. But, you know, when you still have to maintain a certain level of decorum, you still have to maintain a certain level of being the chief, just as you do when you make the transition to company officer. You know, there are conversations that you can be in, and there's conversations that you should stay out of, and there's times when you know you have to isolate yourself. But they really, we do feel, I think, across the shifts included in that company, and that works out for us. You know what I mean? So you still have a feeling of belonging in that house or in your company or in the battalion, but you do have to isolate a little bit. And I think, you know, one of your topics you talk about is communication across all ranks. What kind of person you are, what kind of leader you are, how you approach your battalion, how you approach the people in it. Like, I know when I was a firefighter too, you know, the interactions with chief officers were, don't want to say tense or stressful, it depended on who the person was, but to try to make yourself available for communication to all ranks, to all levels, impacts how all those people see that
Right.
relationship and how the battalion, like I try to, like when we get people to the battalion, the phrase is like, welcome to the family. You know what I mean? Like we have, everybody's been on board. It's really worked out well. Everybody's supportive of each other. Everybody understands that, when we're maintaining operational and tactical discipline, we're an organization that now runs with predetermined responsibilities and SOGs, which is a difference from the command model that we were when I first got hired. Those guys and girls know that, today might be Danny's day to be the first new engine, which means I'm going to do the best job possible to be the second new engine and make sure their line's in place and everything's working and my backup line is ready to support them and their water supply is established and all those things are there, and then maybe next shift's going to be my day, to be the first new engine. And as long as everybody's in that mentality and in that family and kind of support culture, where the battalion is operating as a team, not, Engine 33 is a team today, we all look good if we all work together. So while it's you're operating alone, you're also, operating as a whole unit. You
Right.
know what I mean? So it gives a different level of impact. So it feels like you're alone, but it doesn't also because they're my team. You know what I mean?
Gotcha. Okay. With that being said, with you currently now being a battalion chief, what does the term aggressive mean to you?
I think aggressive to me means educated risk taking. I think we're in such an instant gratification society that everybody wants the result without the work, right? So I think we're in such a that kind of society. Everybody thinks that everything's going to come at the snap of a finger. We have short attention spans. And I think what people see, I mean, you live in the internet world and you get around, and I know you go to conferences and you see things other places, and the world is quick to critique, either critique unjustly or try to emulate something that they may not be completely prepared for. You know what I mean? So people may see a photo or a video or a snippet of a company operating or a department operating or an individual operating that looks reckless, but it's in a fraction of time,
Right.
right? So I think a lot of times people push that aggressive moniker on things that without the work, right? Without the investment, without the work, without the preparation, without all those things, you or I or somebody else may be able to deploy quickly or act quickly or, respond to an event, what some may say aggressively, but it might be based on a vast wealth of knowledge or experience or any of those things. And I think where we see people get in trouble or that action bites people is if you get these kids that are watching something on the internet and they see that 15 seconds of, that's the way you do it, but they're not looking at hours and years and hundreds of responses or other fires with which all that decision making is based upon that made that 15 seconds happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like if 18-year-old me had watched a video and said, all right, I'm going to do everything that way based on the decisions that a 30-year guy is doing, it's different. You know what I mean? So I think it's just a it's a hard time to kind of live and know, kind of where you're at personally, and then apply those things and the risks that that you take. You know what I mean? The
Right.
risks that I took as a, 18, 25, 30, childless or single and childless at some points person are different than the risks I take as a 44-year-old person. You know what I mean?
Right. Okay. And with you having, an entire shift or platoon, if you will, that's under your, I don't want to say like under your command, but you are the battalion chief. What are your non-negotiables for the men and women that work for you?
So I pump out. It didn't change a lot from a station commander to a battalion commander. Some of the verbiage changed a little bit, but some expectations, the big expectation document, and probably non-negotiables are we're going to treat each other with respect, right? We're going to treat the public with respect. Our apparatus and our equipment is going to be ready every hour of every day. We're going to do whatever we can to prepare ourselves as best as possible through training. And I think the rest of it is just about being good people. You know what I mean? But really, if you show up on time, which is respectful to the people around you, because you're letting the people that are getting off, leave, arrive ready to be at work. If you're having a problem, we'll get you through a problem. But, come ready to work, come ready to drill, come up with ideas, all those things. We can work with the rest. If we can be tactically prepared and operationally prepared, and then ready to be at work, everything else is good. You know what I mean? But the big thing, I mean, the big thing is the soft skills of being able to approach each call, knowing that while it might be your 30th call of the day, it's their first call, the civilian's first call, and it's their emergency, and we're going to treat them with respect, and we're going to treat our coworkers with respect, and make sure everybody, works as hard as they can to make sure that everybody gets to go home at the end of the shift. Those are kind of my non-negotiables.
Okay. And as far as leadership, what kind of leader did you want to be when you finally realized, like, hey, I'm gonna take this position, but also what does leadership look like to you?
That's a big question. I wanted to be tactically proficient enough that my decision making would be trusted.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
So, operationally backgrounded, training backgrounded, respected and proficient enough to be trusted. What are the things you look for in leaders, right? So consistency, clear expectations, clear communication, open channels of communication up and down the rank, tactically proficient, knowledgeable, understanding, capable, all those kinds of things. So I think that was the leader that I wanted to be, and I think that was based on just as anybody, right? That's based on the leaders that you had that weren't necessarily leaders.
Right.
The examples we learn sometimes more from bad examples than good examples, right? So you try to fix or correct the models that you saw that didn't work, and emulate those that you wanted to be like or made an impact in your life. And that's really kind of the level of leadership that you're looking for. You know what I mean? We had, I don't want to say we've had some people come in either as a company officer or like as a company officer when they were, working with firefighters, or as a company commander working with officers, or any of those things. If you can improve people as employees, improve who they are as firefighters, that's great. If you can improve people that are struggling, on and off the job, that's immense, right? So if you can, we provide clear direction and, strong incident scene management and command presence and all those things, on the fire ground. But if you can also positively impact people outside of the firehouse, where they go home and they have a successful life and they're successful parents and they're, successful partners, then that's huge as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. Okay, I love it. It's for me what you said earlier about having being able to make sure that you're tactically and proficiently sound speaks volumes, because like if you have a company officer or battalion chief or whoever is in command or in charge of a scene tell you, I need you to do this, and you know that's not the right thing, no one's gonna trust you. Like that's big.
And that's a hard thing, right? And sometimes, I know one of the things you talk about is like preparation for promotion. There's people out there that are mastering how to complete a process successfully without doing the work to be a successful firefighter. You know what I mean? And we have some people that have done an immense amount of preparation that are now trying to get experience. You know what I mean? And that's a struggle, right? And we all have different career paths. People's, not everybody can be at all the places where they're going to get the most experience. It's just not physically possible, and that's where things like getting a wider breadth of knowledge from outside training or outside influences, or we talked about mentors inside and outside your department, finding voices from other places that may be able to share experiences with you. All those things to try to gain as much knowledge and that competence as possible. You know what I mean? And when we're working with a battalion and we're working with firefighters and we're working with recruits and all those things, to try to be diverse in your knowledge of tactics. You know what I mean? Because what's going to work for Danny B that's doing squats in full gear in the parking garage at a training conference, is not necessarily going to work for somebody that's 5'4" and 130 pounds. You know what I mean? So you've got to be accepting and diverse in your knowledge enough to say, this is how I do it. You can try that. Okay, that doesn't work for you. I've also seen it done this way. Let's try that. Okay, that didn't work for you. Okay, let's try this third way. And all of them are right. You know what I mean? We very rarely, we talk about, always and nevers are terrible things to say, because there has to be gray area. This isn't a black and white field, So that's where that real diversity of experience and that tactical competence and tactical awareness of all of the different ways to really become, a professional and knowledgeable, fire officer and firefighter, so that you can again support that family atmosphere and make sure the unit succeeds. Not, I'm looking for me to succeed. I'm looking for just my engine to succeed. I'm looking to help everyone. Let's help everyone be the best that they can be. You know what I mean?
No, for sure. Okay. And you kind of hit on the next question I was going to ask you. How important is it to get outside of your own department, your own four walls, when it comes to outside training?
Oh, it's absolutely irreplaceable. When I got hired in 2002, we were a strict command driven department. You were expected, essentially, you had to know everything, right? Because as you arrived, the chief gave you tasks, and you could be arriving as an engine and doing truck work, and you could be arriving as a truck and stretching a line, and then we had quints for a little while, which adds a whole nother layer of what are you going to be today? And we operated kind of in that way because it was, well-intentioned, good, kind of regionally accepted for the time. But then we started to have some outside influence, in like, I'm trying to think time-wise, 2014, 2015, outside influence from other jurisdictions came in as chief officers and changed some things and implemented some operational bureau directives or SOGs. And then we had a turnover administration, and we had another assistant chief from another organization to the west of us around like the nation's capital that implemented a little bit further refinement of that system. And those, so that shows the impact that outside ideas can have on an organization, right? So while that's at the chief level, if you are a firefighter and you're in, you kind of talked about like undesirable assignments or undesirable stations or crews or whatever, you may not be getting what you need in the house you're in, or in the department you're in, or in the company you're in, or in any of those things. So you have to go out and find it. You know what I mean? And find the people that are willing to put that information out. But you also have to vet those sources, right?
Absolutely.
That and that outside information, because anybody can kick up a training company at this point in the world, and anybody can make a TikTok and plug in some ChatGPT things and spit out some things, and you have to kind of see who they really are and vet who they work with kind of and what their experiences have been and find out if they're a reliable resource. But take some of that outside training and then also siphon that down from there are great things that I can learn from guys in, New York City or wherever else, but there are very few of us that are operating with that staffing, that infrastructure, that system, that redundancy of personnel. You know what I mean? So the things that you're in North Carolina, right? Right. So how many people are on your rigs?
We're fortunate. So we are assigned five. Most of the time, we
Okay.
ride four.
Okay. So, but a four-person company is going to operate much different than a six-person company. Or if I'm in, the southeast somewhere, and I'm still running. When I first became a company officer, it was me and a driver if the transport unit was out. You know what I mean? So we were a double house. There was an engine and a truck, but the engine had two on it. And then if the transport unit was in, we ran heavier. But if they were out, which they were, we were responding with two. You know what I mean? I can't take six-person tactics and apply them in my two-person engine company, but I can take the things that I may learn related to fire behavior, fire dynamics, ventilation practices, building construction. I can take those kind of non-negotiable scientific fact items, nozzle flows, nozzle reaction, hand line weights, any of those things. They're science. Those can be applied anywhere. Deployment models and some of those things you have to filter through and figure out what's applicable to you and then bring it back. But yeah, outside training, outside influence. I know you and I met in Greensboro. I've attended that conference since 2009. You know what I mean? So what do they put out? 12 programs each conference. Probably, it used to be, maybe nine to 12. So if they kick out 12 things, two times a year at this point, that's a lot of influence, And it also builds, like, I know you've got a network through this. You have a lot of phone numbers in your bank if you need to reach out to somebody. It also builds the communication and the back and forth where, again, you're trying to seek out mentors, or you're trying to seek out information, or any of those things. When you go to those events and you build relationships, or you make contacts, or any of those things, somebody else is going through nozzle selection the same time you are, and as your career advances, somebody else is writing policies the same time you are, and you have a whole bank of people to reach out and say, "Hey, man, we need a rapid intervention policy," or "We need, what are you guys doing in non-hydrant operations?" Or, "How do you deploy your search companies?" Or any of those things. You know what I mean? So outside training is absolutely immense.
You mentioned earlier back in the day, Anne Arundel was more like command driven. Now I'm assuming you guys are more engine truck type model based. That shift in culture going from that to where you are now, was it a difficult transition, and was it something the members really wanted more than the administration?
It was a little bit difficult as far as growing pains, but I wouldn't say wanted it more than the administration, because it came with an administration change. Does that make sense? So the timing was initiated with a change in county government. So we have a county executive. The county executive appoints the fire chief. The fire chief then, has some appointed positions that are open for their assignment. So that came at a time where we had changed the administration. We changed the fire chief. The fire chief selected an assistant chief, and then those things came along. The OBDs came along, and I think, I don't have a concrete number of a percentage, but everywhere, for the most part, is built of people that come from other places. We hire plenty of people from outside of our jurisdiction. There were a lot of people that were operating, trying to operate that way, kind of, I don't want to say not under the radar necessarily, but you had neighboring companies that had understandings of, we're laying out every time I'm going to call out a hydrant. Like, you were creating unofficial SOGs within a shift or a battalion as to how you were going to try to operate, to try to streamline operations and make them efficient, and reduce kind of radio chatter and improve communication and all those things. So that first assistant chief, right, came over, was appointed. He wore some scars of trying to make those changes, and a little bit of resistance probably. And then we had another administration change, and our current assistant chief has continued to really refine the OBDs, our core beliefs and our operational manuals to. But he also had the benefit of not being, the first one to flip the page either. So, I think it was something that had to happen. And when you look at, the major impacts, or the major things that influence, like, those NIOSH top five things, right? So, clear lack of policy, clear failure to adhere to existing policies, right? So if you're looking at those things as the puzzle pieces that repeatedly lead to firefighter line of duty deaths in IDLH atmospheres, right? We're not talking about cardiac issues or tanker rollovers, or those things, right? True, operational fire ground line of duty deaths. Why would you not do everything you could to take those puzzle pieces away? You know what I mean? So that's a really hard thing to argue against.
I just like to ask because my organization, I think we're heading down the right path where we have two truck companies. One's a straight stick, one's a tower ladder or a mid mount, whatever you want to call it. And we're trying to like where when the ladder gets on scene, one of the captains is real big about like if it's a structure fire and it's, a two-story residence, he wants ladders thrown. He wants the truck companies to position the apparatus, not park it, and then like assign a search, either search, vent, like let's do truck work while the engines take care of, mitigating the problem, extinguishing the problem. And I see it as a benefit because whether you're command driven or whatever the case may be, if companies arrive on scene knowing what they need to do, the faster they can put out the problem, the faster the issue goes away.
I
So.
mean, so is there, what's your question there? Kind of,
No, I was just
okay.
pretty much just talking about like
Yeah,
how
absolutely.
I love how you guys have evolved in a sense where it used to be, because you mentioned Quint's. Granted, our truck, it's a Quint. We have hose, we have a first due, we are by ourselves. There's no other company with us. So we have to adapt where if we arrive on scene first, as much as we would love to go do truck work, if the next closest engine's not for a couple minutes out, we're gonna have to stretch a line and do engine company functions.
You're the engine. And we had very rare instances of that. I remember, so where I was a driver, I was 28. Quint 4 was right up the street in a newly opened firehouse. And I was actually assigned to 4 when they opened and then transferred to 28, just due to a vacancy. And we had very few instances where Bill Smith was the driver at 4 at the time, where like we ran up and he's running the pump panel because they had a first due, same as you're talking about, right? But I had been assigned there, so like we truly used the Quint as both functions that day. You know what I mean? So it, but that's not a normal occurrence, right? So absolutely, the benefit of SOGs or having a policy-driven department where you have clear expectations of the companies and the engine companies are doing engine company work and the special services are picking what their incident priority is, right? There's a battle of, what are our knowns versus our unknowns? Do we have, is search is always indicated, but is search a priority? Do we have any reported victim location or any of those things, or is vent a priority? And how do we most effectively improve the fire ground? We're still, we're 10 years into these policies being in place easily, and we're still working to refine and improve our choices with incident priorities and our command level assignment of tasks and all those things, and working together at a command level. Under the assistant chief and our operations performance chief, to improve those things, to better refine, to keep moving that bar forward, beyond just setting the policies. So yeah, it's absolutely immense. And it makes, as good as it was, I think it made some strong company officers when we were command driven, because you had to be able to do everything. It's also massively chaotic, right? When you have, barring a severe like arrival out of order, or some kind of operational delay that changes where you hit the run card, when you know exactly what your expectation is and what the job that you're going to perform is from the time the dispatch drops all the way until you're arriving. The side Charlie company, I talked about a little bit in Greensboro about doing recon, right? The companies, so for us, it's fourth and fifth due engine and the second due truck, right? Have a much better idea of what their anticipated deployment is going to be, and can use that to pre-plan their positioning, pre-plan, If they happen to pull the house up, what am I looking at? What can I tell from the BIR? What's my ladder selection going to be based on, one story, two story, split foyer, split level, all those things. Yeah, you can't argue with predetermined responsibilities.
Definitely. Okay. I definitely want to hear your take on this. The maintaining motivation in a non-aggressive department.
Okay. So I,
Because that's difficult.
yeah, well,
I think there are a lot of firefighters that are going through that right now.
and it can be. So in, I think it was like 2012, 2012, I got kind of hooked up with another organization and did a little bit of lecture stuff and was fortunate to be paired with a special operations battalion chief out of Chicago.
Okay.
So I was a company officer as a lieutenant right outside of Annapolis. Pat was a battalion chief in Chicago, and we kind of did like dual organizations, like big city urban fire department versus metropolitan combination department. And at the time we were still operating in that command model. We were heavy on EMS. We had like kind of pulled some people, browned some companies out to increase transport units because we had a heavy EMS need. I get the need from the administration. But the whole conversation was kind of about creating operational tempo and working in a department that's not designed that way and trying to be motivated, without coining that term incorrectly, aggressive, in a reserve department. And I think your motivation, it's really hard to maintain like a self level of motivation, right? So there's no way that you're the only person. So
Right.
you have to find the network inside your department of, there might be a guy in a station on an opposite shift. There might be a girl down the street, that you knew from recruit school that you can bounce information back and forth. Hey, look at this. Hey, look at that. Hey, look at this article. Hey, you want to go to this conference together? Any of those things, right? And then I kind of get your question of, but when the department doesn't support it, right? And then that's where you seek out that outside training, find those mentors, whether they be inside or outside your department, and then work to get yourself into a position where, and sometimes it's going to just take time and attrition, right? And you kind of have to do the best that you can to improve yourself individually before you're given the opportunity to improve a company or whether you stay a firefighter two rank forever, right? And you move into where you're the quotation of the senior man, right? And then you're influencing new people and then you're creating a culture within your department of that motivation because you're now somebody that's influencing the people coming up, or you choose to advance in a career and put yourself in positions to influence and change the department. You know what I mean? Those are, you can either kind of, the Aaron Fields theory of water boils from the bottom, right? Is a phrase that he puts out. So you can be super motivated firefighter twos and work together to do the best you can at that rank. You can do single firefighter glove on mask up drills all by yourself with nobody supporting you in the bay, as long as you maintain your conviction and you don't listen to, somebody that's riding a recliner that wants to tell you that that's a waste of your time. Because you're going to show them up, right? And it doesn't have to come with bravado and it doesn't have to come with an I told you so mentality. You just know that you're doing the best that you can absolutely do. And then choose whether you as a whole are going to try to move the department up, or there's no way that pockets of those people aren't going to move into the positions to where you're impacting apparatus purchases, right? Or impacting gear and equipment purchases, or impacting policy development to where you start to see a department shift and change and kind of turn a corner and then be a place where motivated people want to work.
Okay, love the answer. So my last question, I always like to ask the guests, where would you like to see yourself before you decide to hang it all up?
Okay. So I've got a pretty clear end date, right?
Okay.
I've got four kids. My youngest is five. I'm gonna try to do 35 years, which will put me out like the summer before she's a senior in high school. So my anticipation is that I'm going to ruin her last year of high school because I will be there for everything. It's our last opportunity as parents, right? So
Okay.
we are gonna I want to be there to every game, every concert, every everything. You know, I'll make up for her kind of I've done a lot for the others and I'll continue to, but you know, she's gonna be our last shot, right? So that gives me 12 years.
Okay.
You know, I don't think our next rank is a division chief, which is shift. We have four shift commanders, and then we have division chiefs that run our IT, essentially communications and computers. One runs logistics, so apparatus purchasing and equipment, and the training academy. I may dabble in the pursuit of division chief. Because again, that impact of I enjoyed impacting a company. I enjoyed, you know, I enjoyed impacting a shift. I enjoyed impacting a company. I enjoy impacting a battalion. It would be cool to run a shift. It would be cool to run the training academy. Those would both be kind of rewarding ways to finish out a career. I think that's probably that would be it. You know, otherwise, I'll love being a battalion chief and maintaining, you know, 1/16th of our fire department's, you know, kind of culture and mindset, and that's equally rewarding as well, you know. And then I don't know if I get done where I am and the volunteer company down the street is like hiring engine company chauffeurs or something, I'll go back to wheeling a rig with personal responsibility only. You know, kind of more for fun than anything else. But yeah, I think that's probably about as high as I want to go.
Okay.
I didn't think I wanted to be a captain. You know, I kicked and
Right.
screamed going to lieutenant. I didn't want to leave a great shift to go be a captain. I, you know, I shed a lot of tears leaving captain to be a battalion chief. So, you know, they're all great. As long as you make them great, every single rank is as great as you can make it. You know what I
That's
mean?
right. That's right. Now I like that because you often hear everyone always ask the question, what's the greatest rank in the fire service? And I always hear company officers like number one, but I like how you stated it's all on what you make it, what at whatever rank you're in. Like it doesn't, I guess I think the greatest impact can come from company officers, but as far as what's the greatest rank, I think it's all individually dependent on the person. Because you make or break, however, like for me, it's driver. And because I feel like drivers don't get the credit, especially when everything goes good. Nobody cares about the driver. It's like, yeah, you did your job, you pumped some lines. But God forbid if something goes wrong, a hydrant's out, or the truck takes a dump, and the driver's got to think on the fly what you got to do, or something goes wrong with the water. And then it's like everyone looks at the driver. But honestly, man, like true drivers from knowing where you're going, making sure your company officer doesn't really, hey, you know where you're going, just one time has to say, yep, I got it. All right, cool. And then every tool, every item that you need is right there. And just to me, that's the greatest role.
Yeah, but what a, you know, in the chauffeur role, right? What an amazing amount of responsibility on the fire ground, right? It may only be for 45
Right.
seconds,
Right.
but in that 45 seconds, man, it's fourth and goal, right?
Right.
And then what an amazing amount of knowledge that they need to have, and the ability to problem solve, right? As a driver, there's not a whole lot that's more satisfying than when everything goes wrong and you make it go right, right?
Right.
Or when
Right.
you can, squeeze that truck or that tower ladder in somewhere where nobody thought you were going to get it, or straddle a bridge that's just rated for your engine and get draft out of something that nobody thought you were going to supply a fire ground with. You know what I mean? There's such a great opportunity to be a problem solver, and then support that team operation, and know that you're a small part of a really big success story, right? Like,
Definitely.
chauffeurs got every, like I said, every one of those jobs is something great, right? It's exactly what you make it. And I think, we had talked in Greensboro about embracing challenges, or
Yes.
embracing being be comfortable with becoming uncomfortable, right? So, if you go to an admin job that you didn't want to be in, then do your absolute best as, a training lieutenant. Or if you get, I don't know how everybody's department works, if you end up
Right.
in a communications role, then make sure that you're providing top-notch information to the guys and girls in the field, right? And make sure that we're deploying resources as best as we can, right? Or any of those things, and making sure that whatever you're doing creates positive impact, right?
Right.
In every role. But yeah, every one of them. You could say the nozzle firefighter is absolute key. Yeah, true. The special service firefighter in performing search and vent and all those things, we used to joke that the tillerman was the best job ever, right? Because you're alone, and typically you were like an OV position, or your predetermined assignment was going to the roof, right? That's a great job too. Every one of those jobs is fantastic. Company officers, great. Small unit leadership, all those things. Company commanders, great. Impacting multiple shifts of personnel if you're hands on, if you do a good job with it. So just embrace where you are, do the best you can in those roles, and that will pay dividends, for generations within your department. It's, some you talked about mentors. I had great driver mentors, right? So even in that slow assignment, I had Vince Janowick and Charlie Gettler were two great drivers, right? So as a rookie, I had two great drivers to impact me. Even in that volunteer live-in position, I had great apparatus operators, that impacted my entire career. So you're not just doing the best for you, you're doing the best for all the people that come behind you. You know what I mean? Because they always watch. They're seeing everything you do, and they're going to model behavior after the people that they know are doing the right thing. You know what I mean? So every rank's a great rank,
Definitely. Definitely. Okay. Well, one last question I want to ask, because you mentioned it and it sparked the notion in my head. You mentioned getting comfortable being uncomfortable. So presenting at training days in, out in that, in the at the theater, was that uncomfortable for you? Because I mean, you still knocked it out the park, but is that something one of your mentors pushed you to do? Because I'm sure if somebody approaches, hey, I'd like for you to speak at this conference where I have like 100 something people, a couple hundred different firefighters from all over the country come, like, what was that like for you?
So, yeah, that's I mean, I think that's a well-known thing, right? People say they'd rather be dead than speak at a funeral, right? Because of the pressure. So I had, like I said, I had kind of, I don't want to say dabbled in that. When I was assigned to the training academy, I had done hands-on instruction for Firehouse Magazine. I had, done some presentations for Firehouse Expo when they were still in Baltimore. So it's a thing that I had done, but I don't want to say in a previous life, but it was like 2012, 2015. Like I either hadn't had kids or had just had kids, You know what I mean? And I really hadn't touched it again in a long time. And the deal with training days, you know, I don't know that I would go out and do it a lot of other places, you know, Wells and Mac and Foundation and that organization. It was an opportunity to give back for them because they asked for it. You know what I mean? So it's more a favor to friends than trying to go out and like self-promote. You know what I mean? Because I would rather impact, you know, the guy or the girl that's sitting next to me. I would rather have the opportunity to have, you know, an officer do OJT or you know, at this point now, another battalion chief do OJT and try to instill as many values as you can that way. Because there's a lot of questionable content out there, right? And you have to really look at what people's motives are that are trying to push information your way. And are they trying to do something to improve the greater good and provide something for people, or are they trying to promote themselves? And it's a fine line, you know, in the even, you know, you and I talked about this, and I told you how hesitant I was to get on a podcast with you initially, just because of what the environment is. So it was uncomfortable. It was kind of, you know, it was fun. It came together because I wasn't trying to push like a researched narrative. You know what I mean? Like it was really just, I'm going to tell you some things I do. And honestly, Mac asked, I'm going to do an engine company class in Alexandria, and it'll be fun. You know, that's a big theater too, and it's a huge honor. And it, you know, used to be named after an individual, and to be in any way associated with that is immense. So I'm happy to do that favor for those friends, because that too is an organization and a family at this point, and long-lasting relationships, you know, and people in a network that you can, like, when I was battling with the promotion, McMaster's from Alexandria was one of the guys that I asked, you know, would you do it all over again? You know, and he kind of, you know, I think at that time he told me to run away, but he's like, no, nah, I mean, you probably really should. So yeah, you know, and you get to a point where you want to create challenges for yourself, right? So if I'm at the highest rank I want to be at, then I still want to find a way to challenge myself. You know what I mean?
With that being said, I really appreciate you. Even after I asked you in Greensboro, but I appreciate you thinking about it because, like, I mean, there was a lot to think of. It's like, well, I'm going to put my name out there. People are going to listen to this. People that know me and things like that. But you came through. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I enjoyed your presentation in Greensboro, and I just want to say thank you for actually trusting me and accepting the invite, coming on and talking shop.
No, I mean, I told you I kind of, you know, I jumped on, I listened to a few of what you'd put out, and you know, I kind of appreciated your hustle in Greensboro. I appreciate your love for it. You're doing great things. It's not filled with, you know, bravado and you know, patting yourself on the back type stuff. It's good stuff. You're getting a lot of perspectives from a lot of people, and from all kinds of, you know, varying experience levels and tenure and departments and all those things. So, yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to have the conversation. This has been a fun chat.
Awesome.
I'm glad we got to know each other a little bit. And you know, I told you before, if you need anything, don't hesitate to call.
Definitely. I appreciate it. No, and that's one of the things I like to do. I like to talk to all different walks. I don't care if you're retired, active, 40 years, 6 months. I truly believe that anybody that really loves the job, it doesn't really matter your rank or your years of tenure. It's all about your work ethic and how you expose yourself and who you surround yourself with. So, like I said, Chief, thank you again for coming on.
Man, thanks for having me, Danny.
Sir.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.